If you are sitting at home next to your radio, you're hearing the music faster than you are if you're in the hall.
Listening for the secret. Searching for the sound. This is The Sound Podcast with Ira Haberman. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and Twitter. Now, here's Ira.
The Sound Podcast is part of the OSIRIS Network. OSIRIS connects you with podcasts, videos, and live experiences about the artists and topics you love. Visit OSIRISPod.com to check out our shows. In fact, you should check out No Simple Road or Inside Out with Turner and Seth. Both are great shows. OSIRIS works in partnership with Jambase, which connects music fans with the music they love and empowers them to go see live music. For more, check them out at jambase.com. The show starts now.
And on and off and on and off and on again.
You've been listening to Corner Painter, the first track on Tal Wickenfeld's sophomore record, Love Remains, which has been out since mid-March, and shame on you if you haven't heard it. Even more shameful probably is if you've never heard of this absolutely prodigious woman who has played bass for the likes of Herbie Hancock and Jeff Beck. Her career has already been a fairy tale for anyone into classic rock and music more generally. She counts people like Jackson Brown, Benmont Tench, and others as friends, which in and of itself is so random and so crazy. She has also sat in with the Allman Brothers, which we'll get to when we chat with Tal, and Bob Weir and Wolf Brothers, and so many others. But what makes her even more outstanding than just her talent at bass is her ability as a songwriter and singer. Notice, I separated the two and didn't simply call her a singer-songwriter. It's because this young woman writes amazing songs and sings like no one else you've ever heard. We've been trying to get in touch with Tal for quite some time because we are intrigued by her story, but mostly her talent. Our conversation started when I asked about her first noted public performance on stage, March 21st, 2006, with the Allman Brothers Band.
I'd met O'Teal and Derek in New York because I was, you know, playing in clubs every night. And I started attending their shows and watching them play. I hadn't previously heard of the band before meeting them, but quickly became a fan. And then one night, that night that you speak of, O'Teal just walked off stage and I walked on stage. And I just remember it was pretty funny because he went into the crowd and watched me from the audience. It was a really memorable night, especially because it was in memory of Elizabeth Rhee, and it was like a 40-minute version of the song. And
of course,
and at one point, they have a bass solo in the song, and so the whole band walked off the stage, and I was just there on my own, like playing solo bass for about 5 minutes, which is pretty funny considering the fact that really the first time I was, on a real stage performing to the public. I mean, I definitely played in bars and whatnot to, three people. But that was the first time. So, what a memory.
And so I've seen shots of you, a young Tal with her hair all braided out, dreads. And all kept neatly, and there you are up on stage. And I would imagine, having seen the Allman Brothers at the Beacon Theater, as your story goes, not just that night, but nights prior, and knowing O'Teal, certainly O'Teal's influence on your music must be substantial as another amazing, talented, prodigious bass player. I mean, talk about O'Teal's playing and how it influenced your own.
Yeah, it was like there were three bass players that, when I moved to America, really, kind of took me under their wing, like almost immediately after meeting them. And it started with Marcus Miller in LA, and then when I moved to New York, Anthony Jackson, and then I met O'Teal. And like, they're also like, three of the world's, finest bass players. So it's pretty awesome that they spent time with me and shared their insights. And I absorbed a lot. And it also takes, it takes a sort of a very, it's courageous, I believe, for O'Teal to have, walked off the stage and let me go on stage with me having no track record. Like that's a courageous move on his part, and that means so much to me to know that he believed in me strong enough to sort of potentially jeopardize his his own gig. I've just been blessed with a lot of people like that in the music industry who have really, I guess, taken a risk with me and just supported me. And, I'm so grateful because I'm just so grateful.
Before we get to what happens next, I do want to go back to a bit of a backstory here, in that you were in Australia, you decided to quit school, probably not something your parents were necessarily into, and pick up your guitar and go west, young lady, and go to LA, right? That's the way the story goes. I'm curious about the switch from guitar, which as an instrument is difficult, but very different in terms of tone, in terms of the number of strings you play, in terms of your role in a band, to bass. And what made you decide to make that switch?
It was a number of factors that all sort of like collided. Firstly, when I was playing guitar, I was always really, really interested in bass. But then when I moved to America and when I was living in Australia, I think my family just sort of wanted me to be focused on academia. Mm-hmm. And so I wasn't really allowed to practice for more than half an hour a day.
Right.
Which was like torture for me, because, as soon as I picked up guitar for the first time, I fell in love with it. And I just wanted to be playing music constantly. So as soon as I moved to America, I started not necessarily practicing 6 hours a day, but playing 6 hours a day, because, I went to this school. And so it was just playing all the time. And I gave myself tendonitis. And when I went to see a hand doctor about it, he said, well, you better take a rest. And I'm thinking, okay. And I said, so that's a shame. I have to take, what am I going to do for 3 days? And, but it turns out he meant I had to take a break for about 6 months.
Oh.
So during this extended period of time, I started drumming with one hand and playing bass with one hand, and I was playing a lot of polyrhythmic stuff. So I suppose once it was time to play again, I'd made this decision to switch to the bass. And a lot of people were like, you sound like a rhythm section player. You sound like a bass player. And sure, I could have continued and played guitar. And, there's so many amazing guitarists that are great rhythm guitarists too. But there was something that just drew me to the bass. So it was a bunch of reasons, I suppose, but it's funny that now I'm playing a bit of guitar again, so,
You've kind of gone full circle, and we do want to talk about the record, but I want to talk about how we get back to the record in just a second. Used that performance of Elizabeth Reed, I guess you got a tape of it, and the next story after story in your career to this point is that of fairy tale. You used and it's outstanding. I don't know if it speaks to gumption or talent or a combination thereof, but it's incredible.
I love gumption's my favorite cleaning product in Australia.
Great.
Of gumption?
No, we don't. I don't. But I assume it gets the job done, right? I mean, it just...
It does.
Right. So that makes sense then, because you use a recording of that performance to try to at least introduce yourself to another Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, and that's, I think, how most of us have come to know you. Tell us about Jeff Beck and sending that tape to Jeff.
Yeah, well, it actually happened because when I was still at that school, I was asked to perform alongside a drummer who was doing a drum clinic.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked the school to choose their most qualified bassist and guitarist, and I guess they picked me. And I've been playing 2.5 months at this point. And I obviously I'd had, you know, a couple years of guitar playing under my belt. But yeah, I was pretty new to the instrument. But anyway, turns out the drummer was best friends with Vinnie Colaiuta. So Vinnie came, and that's when I met him, and he said, well, one day we should play. And I thought, yeah, okay. Because I'd already heard like a ton of recordings of him, and but I'd made plans to go to New York City because I really wanted to just be in the jazz scene there and playing in clubs every night and just doing that whole thing.
Right.
And so I didn't contact him until I decided to move back to L.A., which was a few years later. Like, basically, like, maybe it was, like, a few months after this Allman Brothers thing. It wasn't too long after. I don't remember exactly.
Right.
When. Bit of a blur. Uh-huh. But I remember contacting him then, and we arranged to play. And I played in my record and this Allman Brothers thing, and then he got the call from Jeff Beck's management saying that they needed a bass player because Pino couldn't make this Eric Clapton's Crossroads gig. And so then they asked me to, you know, I sent them the stuff as well, and then they flew me out to audition. And I got the gig, and they ended up booking like a whole tour around it, and then it just went on from there.
And it did go on, and there are, you know, so many people who I remember when Jeff Beck came through Toronto, everybody was talking about how amazing the bass player was, never mind Jeff and how outstanding he was, but how amazing my friends, I remember to this day, how amazing this young bass player was that was playing with Jeff. And then, you know, again, it's absolutely like, I'm sure when you go back and look at all of the people you've played with to date, you must laugh a little bit about the talented people that, as an Australian who probably didn't grow up necessarily listening to these people, you've played with. I mean, it's unbelievable. And what's more unbelievable is that they've taken you under their wing at such a young age. You know, accomplished musicians like Herbie Hancock, who, you know, wrote the book on modern jazz, has a young Tal Wilkenfield playing with him. I mean, it's do you ever like just freak yourself out thinking about the people you've played with?
I don't freak out as much as I feel gratitude. And I think that the funniest part is that, you know, I didn't grow up listening to their music, so a lot of these people were you know, I was meeting them for the first time and playing with them for the first time, and this is before hearing their music. So I kind of learned some of rock history backwards.
Right.
So it's an odd and hilarious experience. So it's almost as if I was coming up in the same era as they were, because they were all sort of discovering each other as they were, you know, coming onto the scene for the first time. So
right.
It was almost like that, like, because I didn't know their history. But, you know, I wonder what it would be like if I had have known their music and how that would have changed my approach to their music. Like, I mean, there's no way to know. Like,
right.
Maybe it was better that I didn't, because I was just sort of, it was just fresh to me. And I was just doing what I did, you know, as opposed to, you know, sometimes when you hear a recording of someone, you sort of, you can make assumptions about what they might want to hear.
Right.
So I didn't have any of those assumptions because I hadn't listened to these records.
Benmont Tench appears on the first version, the original version of Corner Painter that you recorded or released back in 2016. And I know that you credit Jackson Brown as the executive producer on Love Remains. How did you hook up with Jackson and Benmont? And then were they the ones who kind of introduced you to all of this music? I mean, it's you know, I know how I got introduced to this music. I listened to it on the radio with my dad driving around from, you know, errands and such. But how did you get introduced to these phenomenal people and their music?
Well, I met Jackson Brown when I played the 25th anniversary Hall of Fame concert at Madison Square Garden back in 2009.
That little shack, yep.
And he was performing with Bonnie Raitt, and Springsteen was playing, and the Stones, and everyone was playing that night. And so I met Springsteen and Mick Jagger and Jackson Brown and Bonnie Raitt that night, among many other people. And I told Jackson that I'd heard of him through my dad, and we just had a laugh about it. Because I was like, "Oh, my dad thinks you're great," and I said, "Well, I've been writing my own songs and just starting to like get into lyrics again," and so we just made plans to connect back in LA, and we did, and then things just went from there. You know, I'd ask him his advice about things, and just, you know, he was just kind of there every step of the way. I tried songs with different musicians, and he was like a sounding board for me. And then he hired me to play bass with him on some session he was doing for a Bob Dylan tribute album.
Uh-huh.
And he hired Benmont as well.
Of course.
And so I met Benmont there, and they're like, "Okay, let's play." I don't even remember. I think it was. What song was it? It was a classic Bob Dylan song.
Right.
And let's play that. And I was like, "Wait, what is this?" Benmont gives me this look like, "Wait, you don't know this song?" And then that's when they sort of like discovered, like, I hadn't actually listened to Bob Dylan, and then, wow, you know, the Stones. And so they made it a priority to educate me. And I just developed friendships with them from there. And, you know, Benmont was also, you know, exposing me to the music of his band.
Right.
So, which I also didn't know yet.
Amazing. The naivete around it is so fresh and exciting, because I could imagine you listening to these songs for the first time and people like Jackson Brown and Benmont Tench watching you listening to
Dylan. Great memory. Yeah, I have such a great memory of like sitting in a car with Benmont listening to Blonde on Blonde for the first time. it's amazing.
It's weird because, you know, I introduced my daughters to this music, who, you know, they're much younger than you were when you heard this music for the first time. But it gives me, you know, such pride for me to be able to introduce things like, you know, Dylan and the Grateful Dead and the Allman Brothers. And then for my daughter to find John Mayer on her own and say, "Dad, I love John Mayer." And I think, well, you know, John is actually grew up listening to a lot of the stuff that, you know, you say is dad's music, but that's actually John's music too. And that's Tal's music. And that's, you know, that is the music that has compelled us to do you know, I'm a podcaster who talks to musicians about music, and that story, those songs compel me to do what I do, and probably to a certain degree compel you to do what you do. And so it is a great amount of pride that those two guys must have had showing you, or at least playing that music for you.
Yeah, I mean, I have memories of, like, you know, earlier on in my life where, like, my dad said to me, like, hey, you should check out the Rolling Stones, or hey, you should check out Bob Dylan, and I was like, yeah, whatever.
Right.
Like, but, you know, when your parents tell you something, like, whatever. But, like, but then, you know, later on when someone that you're working with and that you respect says, hey, no, you really should.
Right.
Then it's like, oh, okay, you take it seriously.
So it's going to take John Mayer telling or saying in an interview to listen to The Grateful Dead for my daughter to dig them than rather me.
Well, not all kids are like how,
yes.
how
That's how I feel about it, though. But that's enough about me. You have done this thing after a brilliant career spanning, you know, close to a decade or more than a decade, where you've flipped this idea of playing with others to putting out your own music. And as you alluded to early on, you were you know, what we would imagine as a singer-songwriter who was playing guitar and writing her own songs, and have now, for whatever reason, come back to it. What took so long to get back to where we are today?
My songs are about real life, and I needed to live some life, you know, like, 'cause when you're touring around and playing, you see a lot of stages in hotel rooms, but that's not really living. And I needed to allow myself the time to sort of actually be a human and start the process of writing songs and looking into myself and just, you know, I guess rediscovering myself on a deeper level. And that just takes as long as it takes. But it's been, you know, and still is a work in progress. And I just knew that it would be done when it was done.
Right.
Also, this album was done in stages because I made it myself without, you know, the infrastructure of a label. I've now licensed it to a label after, you know, completing it. But I made it on my own. And we recorded this mainly at East West Studios and live. So it's not something that, like, I could do, like, in a garage. Like, it, you know, we did it professionally, so to speak. Actually, not to say that people that make music in garages isn't professional. Like, I have some, there's some amazing albums that are being made right now that are done all on laptops, but it's just not the kind of album I was aiming towards for this one. So it just took time to sort of, like, get all the musicians in one room and do that, and then I'd go and work on some other stuff for a while, and then, you know, did the strings and woodwind overdubs and mixed it and mastered it. And it, all of those phases had big spaces in between. Mm-hmm. And then after completing it, when it was mixed, well, I don't think it was even mastered at the time, that's when I sent it to Pete Townsend, and then I ended up opening for The Who, and then that sort of took me away from figuring out how to release the album for some time. And then some personal stuff happened where I lost quite a few people that were dear to me, and I had to sort of take some more time to myself.
Right.
And then finally found the right label partner in BMG, and then now here I am.
It's interesting that your first record is entitled Transformation, because I would imagine that there's been a greater transformation in your music and your songwriting from then till now than there was from when you first started writing songs for Transformation and when that was released.
Well, I mean, the thing about Transformation is you don't know if I was speaking about a previous transformation or the transformation
right.
to come.
You were seeing, yes, you were seeing into the future, right. How silly of me not to think of that. So what's amazing is that you not only wrote the lyrics for this, but you've also composed, you know, the strings and really had a very, as you say, hands-on approach to all of it. Do you think that your experience to date helped shape? I mean, I listen to songs, even the first track off of the record is so, I don't know if that's something that you, I don't know if Corner Painter, and I know that it's been around for a while, but I don't know if Corner Painter is the type of song that could exist with all of the phrasing and all of the things that you do when you first started picking up bass, before you played with all of these people. I mean, it's certainly, your experience has certainly shaped the way you play music now and the way you write songs now, right?
Yeah, I mean, everything affects everything, and it's, you know, impossible to go back and point out what might have done what.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause also just, you know, when you're writing music, you kind of open yourself up to accessing this sort of infinite knowledge, I suppose. So, you know, that's how you know young kids can tap into this amazing kind of musicality. It's like it's obviously not the years; it's something else.
Right.
But that being said. I also really, I know I could not have made this album without the collaborators that were involved, and I certainly can't take credit for everyone else's hard work, like from Paul Stacey, who produced it with me. I mean, he really, like, firstly, he's such a magnificent engineer.
Right.
Like, I love the sounds that he got on the record, and he works really well with his brother, Jeremy Stacey, who plays drums on it. Like such great drum sounds, and the sound of the whole record. Like I really, really love the sounds that he gets, and then also just musically, like, you know, the suggestions he made about arrangements or whatever. Like that they were priceless. And then, you know, along with that, like I had Blake Mills playing guitar, who's just a phenomenal musician. Like. Beyond being a great guitar player, like he had suggestions that had nothing to do with his role as a guitarist. And, you know, I'm sure you know, like he's a great producer in his own right. And he's produced all kinds of different things. And then Benmont as well, with all of his knowledge coming in there and all of his suggestions. And, you know, he Benmont's, you know, been a part of making some of history's greatest recordings. So
yes.
Then there's Benmont and then there's Zach Ray, who I also feel like he is one of the most underrated musicians I know. Like he's just incredible. Like, and then, you know, and I collaborated on the arrangements with the String and the Woodwind arrangements with a guy named Dave Arch out of England. So there's so many people that were in the mix. And, you know, it took a long time to find this group of people to, you know, to make this dream a reality. But I couldn't have done it without these amazing musicians.
Do you think that you're a better songwriter and player than you are a singer? Because that's the one thing that really struck me. I mean, we're at this point very familiar with your playing and your technique and your style. But the one thing that, you know, really stands out is your absolute beautiful vocals on this record. Do you compare the two? Are they both equally important? Do you spend equal amounts of time on both? I mean, it's just it's so wonderful to hear a very authentic voice mixed with this outstanding playing.
I don't think of myself as a vocalist, even though I'm singing.
Mm-hmm.
I just feel like if I were to get another singer to sing my songs, it wouldn't feel authentic to me. And so I've always wanted to sing my own songs, you know, that are very deeply personal to me. And all my favorite, quote unquote, singers are the ones that aren't like actually, they're not like singers. You know, people like Bob Dylan and Jimi Hendrix and Bruce Springsteen and Leonard Cohen and Paul Simon. And I mean, I have a whole list of people that I just, they sing, they deliver the lyrics and the story. And that's what I aspire to do, is to deliver a story. So I guess I would like to be a storyteller. And of course I have like singers that I admire.
Right.
Anyone from, you know, Aretha Franklin to Jeff Buckley to Etta James. I mean, the list goes on and on and on, but I've never aspired to be a singer's singer.
Right. Well, I think it's certainly up for conversation after you've released this record. Can you talk about Pieces of Me? Because it is the most stripped down song on the record, and probably the most, for lack of a better word, singer-songwriter song on the record. Can you talk about deciding to put that song specifically on this album? Because it is, you know, so genuine, so true, and so different from the rest of the record.
That song came out of me really fast. It's just, I believe it's such a universal experience that, you know, you enter into some sort of a romantic relationship, and then you realize that the other person only loves aspects of you.
Right.
And so I just felt like it was something important to sing about it, to speak about.
Thank you for your time today. I've for sure taken way more time than was allotted to me. Thank you for the record. Thank you for your magnificent performances. We heard you play All Along the Watchtower with Don Was and Bob Weir, and we were ecstatic that you joined.
That was one of the most fun nights of my entire life.
Really?
And here's why.
Yeah.
Here's why. Because I just went to go and watch these guys play. Like, I saw Bob Weir a couple nights prior, and he watched me sing Pieces of Me, actually, at a show in L.A., and they invited me to go to watch their gig. And so I was just, like, sitting and having a nice time in the audience, and the security guy looks at me from afar, and he's, like, signaling me, like, stand up. And I'm thinking, like, wait, what, stand up? Like, and I'm looking around, like, maybe he's pointing to someone else, and he's walking closer to me, like, get up. And I'm thinking, oh, like, what did I do wrong? Like, I wasn't taking any photos. I wasn't doing any drugs.
Right.
But then he's like, oh, come here. Come with me. I'm like, okay. So, like, I followed him. We're walking towards the stage. I'm thinking, what is going on? He's like, hey, do you know All Along the Watchtower? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, well, you're on in 3 minutes. Great. And so I went on stage and had such a great time. I mean, I've listened to so much Grateful Dead now, and they're one of my favorite bands of all time.
Right.
And so it was such a joy to play with all those guys, but you know, I'm a real fan of the Grateful Dead.
That's another amazing bass player, an accomplished bass player who I have seen online has said amazing things. I mean, what a thrill also to be associated with Don was, right?
Yeah, Don is such a powerful force of nature. I mean, what an amazing producer and bass player. Like, he always plays like the exact perfect thing for a song. Like, that's the ultimate musician right there, is someone that puts the song above anything else. And he always does that. He'll never do anything for the sake of flash. And that takes maturity and restraint and musicality. He's got all those things. And on top of it, he's like one of the nicest dudes on the planet. Like, he's mellow and loving to everyone, and such a great person to be around. Yeah, I love it when people just go on stage and they make music for the joy and love of music, and there's no other intentions to prove oneself in any kind of way. And all of those musicians, from, you know, to Bob to Don, you know, that's what they're like, and that's why it's that. If there was the most powerful lesson that I've learned is from just the experience of playing with musicians like that.
Well, I think you're amongst those performers. Thanks so much for Love Remains and for treating us to such outstanding musicality and performances and all the rest. Thanks for your time. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, sure.
I could have talked with Tal for hours, and believe me, I think she would have stayed online about everything. Her playing, the bass, her creative process, the things she hears in her head, what's next for her, and so on. She is an immense talent and one that we should probably absolutely treasure and celebrate. Hers is an unreal story that just keeps propelling her forward. It's bananas and goes to show you that if you have talent and the gumption to do amazing things, it can indeed be achieved. You can learn more about Tal Wickenfield at talwickenfield.com, but seriously, take the time to do a search on YouTube for some unreal performances. Before we leave you, let's hear another track off of Love Remains. Here is the beautiful Pieces of Me.
You say you love me, you say that you care. Can't live without me, desert me, you wouldn't dare. On our first exchange, you saw all the right signs and filled in the blanks with imaginary lies. Now all my colors are here to see. You only we'll
You've been listening to The Sound Podcast. Technical production by Adam Karsh and Andrea Ruse. Inspired by the music we love. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and Twitter. The Sound Podcast is part of the Osiris Network. For more, visit OsirisPod.com. Thanks for listening. Osiris.